This is Norman B's Life Elsewhere, the show about art, media, and culture.
Hello there, welcome to Life Elsewhere. I'm Norman B. I've got a very special show for you. Over the years, I've been lucky enough to interview all kinds of talented people. Many, I will admit, to being a fan of. The list is far too long to go into here, but the names range from superstars to up-and-coming talent in music, art, literature, film, theatre. Then there are the people I've always wanted to interview, people I've met along the way, maybe lost touch with, yet they were important in my life and made a big impact. One such person is my guest, a man I've known since the late 70s, when he was still a student and I was a fledgling DJ. Today, he's known around the world as the originator of Sub Pop and co-founder of the legendary record label, Mr. Bruce Pavitt. I asked Bruce if he would spend some time chatting with me for Life Elsewhere, and he readily agreed. And we both knew we'd have a lot to talk about, and we both were positive we'd prompt each other with fond memories from years past. Because we talked for far longer than 60 minutes, my conversation with Bruce Pavitt will air in two parts. Plus, I asked Bruce to choose music to go along with our conversation. Now, I know that you're going to be surprised when you hear the selection from the man who gave the world incredible music, including Mudhoney, Green River, Soundgarden, Tad, and of course, Nirvana. You're going to hear the conversation in its entirety with no edits. Here then is a conversation with Bruce Pavitt, part one. I don't remember the actual date, I don't actually remember the year, but it was something around 1979, I think. And I remember it was winter. I remember I was bundled up in sweaters and whatever. And I was doing a show at Chaos in Olympia, the radio station there at the Evergreen Community College. And this fellow comes into the studio one time and says to me, "What's that music you're playing?" And I think, for the life of me, I think if I remember correctly, it was Fad Gadget. I think that's what it was. And the fellow that came into the studio asked me for a lift. I was going to back to Seattle and asked me for a ride back to Seattle. And got in the car and we started talking about music. Well, lo and behold, what, 155 years later, he's now known throughout the world as the person that started Sub Pop Records, Mr. Bruce Pavitt. Bruce, welcome to Life Elsewhere.
Thank you, Norman. I appreciate it.
Do you remember that? Do you remember all those years ago? It was a long time ago, wasn't it?
I do remember. In fact, I have a very specific memory of you telling me that your wife, who was involved in the fashion industry, used to go to London and pick up some of the latest records. And you pulled out a 12-inch single by a group called Bauhaus called Bela Lugosi's Dead. And you're like, "Well, let's have a go and let's see what it sounds like."
Yes. You know what's the ironic thing about that is I did a conversation with David J. just a couple of months back. And I told him that story. And he's like, "Oh, my God." Because he said nobody could really believe that anybody had put out a song that was over 9 minutes long. Gosh, that goes back in time. Bruce Pavitt, here you are. Gosh, we got such a lot to talk about, Bruce.
Yeah, man, let's go. I really honor and appreciate our connection here.
Yeah. So let's go back in time. Let's go back in time so people know just a little bit about you. If I remember correctly, and you correct me on this, you grew up in Chicago and you headed out west to Evergreen. So you pick it up from there. Tell me about the beginnings for Bruce Pavitt.
Certainly. Well, I grew up in the suburbs of Chicago, and I was dating a woman in the suburb who had four brothers. Okay. And they all spent all of their money on records. And I mention this because this happened right around 1977. So they got interested in picking up latest punk 7 inches and so forth. They wound up moving to Chicago. And so I would take the train in with my girlfriend who was staying in the suburbs to Chicago, and they had plugged into the punk new wave underground of the city. So that had a huge, huge influence on me. Wax Trax Records, of course, opened in 78. So between my purchases and the purchases of her extended family, I was getting turned on to just about everything that was coming out in 77, 78, 79. In 1979, I moved to Olympia to go to Evergreen, got a show at Chaos. And of course, as you know, Chaos had an amazing record collection because of their indie music policy. 80% of all music that got played on Chaos had to be on a small label. So between Wax Trax Record Store in Chicago and Chaos FM in Olympia, I was really exposed to just about everything that was coming out. And to top it all off, you were coming in with records fresher than anybody because your wife was flying back with them. So I feel that I was extremely fortunate in getting turned on to all of this tremendously creative music.
Yes.
So very, very grateful for that.
Let's just talk a little bit as we're doing the sort of nostalgia thing here and go back in time to those early days. My recollections now, Bruce, are that everybody was just, anybody that was into the music was so enthusiastic. Everybody had an open mind about the music that it seems to me at the time there were no sort of genres as such as there was just all this great new music happening. What's your thoughts about that?
Absolutely. And I think that was probably best exemplified by what is probably one of the greatest record labels of all time, and that is Rough Trade.
Yeah.
Rough Trade, the diversity on that label was mind-blowing. You had Stiff Little Fingers, Augustus Pablo, Young Marble Giants, Cabaret Voltaire, etc. And, you know, of course, later on they did very good business with the Smiths. But the extreme diversity of their roster was very impressive and exemplify just the kind of open-minded spirit of those times.
Yes. What was interesting for me, of course, is that I had come from the UK and been involved in graphic design over there and then came to America and got involved in doing a show at Chaos and then at Crab and then at, gosh, the list goes on. But one of the things that really, of course, from my side of things was that I'd come from London where all this music was happening. But when I got to America, it was just, it was a desert. There was a wasteland of nobody was playing this music until you found places like Chaos. And there was a station in Chicago, the name I can't remember right now. But there were little pockets of it across the country. But it did seem like these people that were involved, like yourself, like myself, sort of connected together over a certain period of time. That was energizing, wasn't it?
It absolutely was. And for your younger listeners who grew up with the internet, the pre-internet era was very, very different. In the amount of time we would spend as record collectors on finding records, It was deep. And when you invest time and money and emotion into discovering music, you have a deeper relationship with it.
Yeah.
Whereas when the world's music is just a click away, I don't think people have the investment that they did at the time. When I was 19 going into Chicago to visit Wax Trax, it would take me an entire day to maybe track down one song.
Yes.
So that song would have a lot of value for me.
Going back in time, and you and I could talk about this for a long time, but just again, as you said, for our young listeners, we didn't have internet. I mean, the connections, when you think about it, I mean, I can remember getting phone calls from Peel. We used to talk to one another, and it was a long-distance phone call, and you had to think to yourself, oh, my goodness, can I afford this phone call? I mean, it was crazy stuff. Even talking to people in New York, you kind of like, how am I going to do this? Yeah.
Expensive.
I'm talking to Bruce Pavitt, a gentleman that has been around the music business in one way or another for quite a long time, and of course is known as the gentleman that started Sub Pop Records. We're going to get to that. I want to take a quick break, Bruce. But what I'd like to do, I'm going to sort of put a surprise in here right now and ask you, If you can choose some music that we can play throughout our conversation, I just want you to pick anything you like, and I've got a vast library, and we'll find it no matter what. So as we go to a break, let's just take a piece of music. Just select something from Bruce Pavitt.
How about She's Lost Control, Joy Division?
Gosh, yes. Oh, God, I can remember the very first time I played this. Bruce, here it is. Bruce Pavitt's choice. She's Lost Control, Joy Division. If you're just joining us, my guest is Bruce Pavitt, and we just heard his first selection. We're going to play music throughout the conversation. That, of course, was Joy Division, She's Lost Control. Bruce, I've got to ask you one question about that piece of music. When you first heard that, just give me just a taste of what you thought.
Well, the entire context would be walking into Wax Trax Records in Chicago, who were huge fans of the Factory label, And I was immediately taken with the production of the music, especially the drum sound that Martin Hannett came up with.
Yeah.
And it really exemplified the artistry of a good producer. He was really like the fifth member of the band, and I was blown away by the mood and the atmosphere. And then, of course, back when people bought records, the texture of the album cover, the tactile sensation of picking it up and having it look and feel different than any of the other records in the store, all of it combined to blow my mind, as it were.
You know, you just touched on something which I'm glad you mentioned, and that's the picking up the album covers and feeling them, the texture, just the tactile thing. In a lot of respects, we don't have that like we used to. A lot of people have grown up, like my son, my teenage son, really doesn't know what albums are. He goes into my vast library that I have and goes in there and is sort of amazed, but he downloads music onto his telephone, and that's how he listens. So I know people are still making vinyl and things are coming out, the sleeves are being printed. I know that, and I totally encourage it. But overall, the art of record sleeves and looking at them and gazing at them for hours on end, has it gone? Is it something you miss?
It is something I miss. And the ritual of not only listening to the music, but appreciating the art, appreciating the liner notes, appreciating the fashion of the people who made the music. It was a synergistic effect, and in doing so, I believe the listener creates a much deeper connection with the artist. So in this day of streaming, when it's really all about the music and not really about the visuals, I think something's been lost. Of course, in this era, we have music video, which is another art form. Mm. But I do miss the ritual of sitting down with the record. I think it's a deeper experience.
There's something about that which I think you'll know, and a lot of people, that a lot of what I call the train spotters, like you and I, that will remember the sort of the little quirky little details. You'd get a record from Rough Trade, and in the inner cut, as the playoff grooves right into the middle of the record, somebody would scratch in a message, and often it was mastered at Porky Prime Cuts in London on those Rough Trade records, and there would be a message scratched in there. Do you remember that?
I do remember that, and I know back in the day with Sub Pop, we used to put little messages in as well.
Yes.
And sometimes there would be music in that last groove. So if your needle didn't pick up and go back to its original space and it just went into the label, sometimes there would be a little sample of music.
I've always been curious about that, about you doing that and about the Porky Prime Cut people doing that. I've always wondered whether it was just a little sort of, I don't know, a little attempt to be a little subversive. What's your take on that?
Absolutely. Well, my take on it is when we got Sub Pop up and going, I remember putting out the first album, which was Sub Pop 100. It was a compilation, trans-regional compilation of music. And I realized that there were things that I could do that major labels really didn't care to do. So indie music fans really got off on those little touches.
Yes.
That seemed maybe extravagant, but it signaled to the purchaser, the fan, that we were all about creativity and we're going to take the extra mile to do little things that the major corporations weren't.
Yes, yes. Let's move to the beginnings of Sub Pop. So there you were at Evergreen State College, and there's a magazine that's being put out by John Foster at the time called Op. Let's talk about that and go on from there.
Certainly. Well, coincidentally, I will share this anecdote. When I was in Park Forest, Illinois, which again, it's a suburb of Chicago, by the strangest coincidence, my mother, who worked in the school system, said, well, you know, Bruce, there's a local school teacher who puts out music, puts out records, and I want you to talk to him. So I met up with this school teacher, and he was reissuing rare rockabilly records from Indiana. Mm. And his name was Cowboy Carl. And we started chatting, and he goes, "My God, you've heard of rockabilly. Interesting. Why don't you come over to my place?" I went over to his place, and I told him, "Hey, I'm going to Evergreen." And he goes, "Oh," he pulls out a copy of Op, and it was literally the first edition of the magazine. And he says, "This is an amazing station. This is an amazing magazine, and you should know about it." And I said, I had no idea. So when I flipped through Op, I saw that the editor was John Foster. I wrote John a letter saying, "Hey, I'm going to be a student at Evergreen. Do you think you can hook me up with a show?" So by the strangest coincidence, my mother introduced me to somebody who was hip to Op.
Wow.
And again, in the suburbs of Illinois, my friend, this is this is literally the middle of nowhere. So I feel that there was, I've had some really profoundly lucky breaks in my life, and that was one of them.
Ah, yes. Yes, indeed.
So the magazine was really the first and only kind of an encyclopedic approach to cataloging indie music of all genres, and it was a huge influence on myself, and I know a lot of other music fans.
Yeah, absolutely. We could go off on a tangent here, Bruce, and talk about Op and talk about John and talk about all that. We're talking to Bruce Pavitt. He's been around, as I said, the music business for an awful long time. He started Sub Pop. We're moving towards talking about that right now. So let's talk about the beginnings of Sub Pop.
Sure. Well, you know, the focus of my show on Chaos was independent rock music. But I realized that even though my favorite label was Rough Trade and I was playing a lot of Rough Trade stuff, I realized that there was not a lot of coverage of indie records from America, especially records from smaller cities outside of New York and LA. So in the spring of 1980, about 6 months after I started my show, which was called Subterranean Pop,
right,
I put out my first zine, which reviewed a number of records from around the country, some of which had rarely been reviewed outside of maybe Op Magazine. And like Op Magazine, I included the address, which was kind of a big deal because back then, a lot of magazines did not include the address of these records. So unless you wanted to fly to New York or to Chicago to specialty record stores, you were not going to get these records. And in some cases, the small regional records weren't even carried by stores like Wax Trax.
Right.
So in effect, it was a networking tool. You could buy the zine, you could get the address, you could send $3 in the mail and get hold of these super rare records. So it was really an effort to encourage people to check out a lot of music that was very hard to get.
You know, that address thing that you just said is so important. Jeff Travers at Rough Trade had my address pinned up on the wall, and that's how I got to be receiving all kinds of music. When I, first of all, as you said, my ex was bringing it backwards and forwards, and then I was getting sent music and letters. I've got treasure troves of letters from people like Mark Riley and all kinds of people asking me if I play their music way back when, and these handwritten notes. Edward Caspell from legendary Pink Dots used to write to me constantly. It takes me back now, Bruce. So there you are. You've got your show, Subterranean Pop, and then you decide to put out a cassette. Let's talk about that.
Certainly. Well, a year later, I'd put out four zines, and by that time, I changed the name to Sub Pop from Subterranean Pop, and I thought, why don't I put out a cassette version? There was a cassette magazine from Australia called Fast Forward that I was inspired by. And I realized that with cassettes, you could, unlike records, you could customize the edition.
Yes.
So,
yes.
Right? So if you wanted to make 20, you could make 20. If you wanted to make 100, you could make 100. So it was very cost efficient. And of course, at that time, I had no money whatsoever. And I started asking bands for demos, piecing them together. And as good luck would have it, I tracked down an illustrator named Charles Burns, who had also gone to Evergreen and was just an excellent artist. And he did the covers for the series of cassette compilations that I put out. So Sub Pop 5 was the first tape, and it did very well. I remember Rough Trade US picked up 200 copies. It wound up selling 2,000 copies. And the bands on the tape were getting fan letters from all over the world. So I felt it was very successful.
Yeah.
And it was very DIY on my part. Again, I started off with maybe a couple $100s, and I kept plowing it back into the zine and the cassettes.
Were you originally, with those cassettes, were you just duping them off yourself at home?
I did have somebody in town who was duping them off.
Ah, okay, yeah. But it's still it was still in those days, it was a long process, wasn't it?
You know, it was. You know, they could make maybe 8 or 10 tapes at a time. But the beauty of the cassette, too, is if you remember the Walkman, the cassette
sure.
Walkman had just come out at that time. So it was very timely, very of the moment to be putting out cassettes. So it was a successful transitional format, you know, went from the print to the cassettes and then ultimately the vinyl.
Right.
And it was kind of a very organic process.
Yes.
That was somewhat affordable.
Side note here, I have in my vast archives, I have a complete section devoted to cassettes and all the different packages that they came in. You remember In Touch? Remember some of the other ones? They were just like these amazing packages that you weren't even sure how to open them sometimes. And you didn't want to spoil it because they were just so beautifully put together. A lot of them just by hand. Gosh, this is so fascinating, Bruce. We're talking to Bruce Pavitz, the founder of Sub Pop Records. He's very involved in the music business still today. Got so many stories to tell us. I want to play another piece of music from... Just you choose something for us, Bruce.
Sure. How about Reddit and Books by Echo and the Bunnymen?
Ah, good one. Love it.
I've seen it in your eyes and I've read it in books.
My guest is Bruce Pavitz, and he's a gentleman that I've known for an awful long time, but we haven't actually spoken for quite some time. He founded Sub Pop Records, and I think everybody that's involved in music is kind of familiar with that name, or people that like music, I should say. We just heard Echo and the Bunnymen. We're going to ask Bruce to choose music throughout this conversation, and I'm just interested in your choices. I want to get to talk to you about music and your take on what's been happening, what has happened, and what's going on now. We'll get to that in a little while. But let's now go forward and talk about how you transformed from a cassette label to putting out vinyl.
So briefly, I was releasing the zines and the cassettes in Olympia from 79 to 83. In 1983, I moved to Seattle. And I wound up doing a music column for The Rocket. And I wound up opening up a record store called Bomb Shelter, yep, which later transitioned to another space and another name called Fallout. I was involved with Fallout for a year. I left. And I remember that there was a customer that was a very active music fan. And I approached him about borrowing some money, because putting out an album was a lot more expensive than doing the tapes. And he committed to loaning me $5,000, which at the time was kind of a big deal.
Yep.
So I had my financing. And then secondly, I asked Sonic Youth, who were one of the most respected bands of the time, if I could license a track called Kill Your Idols. Mm-hmm. And I realized that if Sonic Youth was on board, that just about anybody else I asked would say yes. So I was thinking strategically there.
Ah, yes.
So the record was essentially a compilation similar to the cassettes, only was on vinyl. And it had the U-Men from Seattle, had Steve Fisk from Seattle, had the Wipers from Portland,
right,
etc. And it did very well. I pressed 5,000 copies and sold 5,000 of those, 500 cassette versions of that. So at that time, selling 5,000 records was kind of like having a gold record in the indie world. That was considered very successful.
Yes, it was, yeah.
And that was kind of the start. And because of the zines and the tapes and the columns, I had developed a brand.
Yes. Yes.
When I put out Sub Pop 100, a lot of stores and DJs and writers were familiar with me and familiar with Sub Pop. So really, I spent many years cultivating a brand, I would say from 1980 to 1986, when the first record came out. And so that's a business lesson learned.
Yes.
That if you've got a brand, sometimes it takes many years of cultivating relationships and establishing that brand. So that's really what I was doing in the early 80s. In 1987, I realized that there was a lot of cool music coming out of Seattle and my own backyard. And I had heard this compilation called Deep Six. It was out on CZ Records. Mm-hmm. And the kind of slower, heavier take on punk, which later became known as quote-unquote grunge, was kind of established on that compilation. And from there, from being inspired by that record, I decided to put out a Green River record,
right,
which I did. And then after that, I joined forces with who was to become my business partner, John Poneman, and we released the Soundgarden Screaming Life EP. And that was in 87 as well. So from 87 on, the focus really was on kind of documenting this particular sound that was coming out of Seattle. And as we all know, that eventually blew up and became very popular.
Yes. Bruce, you just touched on two names I'd like to go back to and just reference quickly. That's U-Men and Steve,
yes,
Fisk. Two very, very different acts. U-Men, I knew those guys like you did, and I always thought that they were, in a lot of respects, certainly the forerunners for what was yet to come. Your thoughts?
Well, Yes and no.
Yeah.
I will say they dominated the underground scene in Seattle from like 84 to 86, I'd say. I never missed a show. I thought they were brilliant. They seemed to be more influenced by, let's say, the Birthday Party, for example.
Right.
They were jazzier and more, in a way, more, I hate to use the word intellectual, but I will. They were just a little headier than what came out later. And the grungier bands, one of the reasons they became so popular is that the music was really pretty simple.
Mm.
But it had a lot of heart and a lot of texture to it. And Jack and Dino's production was super raw. Charles Peterson's photo really helped document it. So that was really kind of a different scene. And the U-Men were really, I think, part of the whole kind of post-punk wave of, artier bands.
Yes.
who were really trying to establish a more unique style. Whereas the bands that became more popular in many ways weren't as unique, but brought a lot of spirit and heart to music, which I think was missing in popular music, and which is why I think people resonated with it so deeply.
Yes, I think that you summed that up very well. Steve Fisk, talk to me about Steve Fisk.
Steve Fisk is a fellow Evergreen student. I remember bumping into him the first day I arrived at Evergreen. He was walking around with a stack of Residence records.
Yes.
He also had a huge fro at the time. I've known Steve forever, and he's one of the most creative music producers out there. He really is a genius of sorts. So he's more of a mad scientist type.
Mm-hmm.
He records other artists, but he creates his own stuff. And I remember visiting his home, 1980 or so, and he was working with tape loops.
Oh,
and I remember he was saying, you know, this is like the composer Steve Reich has produced a lot of pieces just using tape loops. And he goes, what's fascinating is that Grandmaster Flash is basically doing the same thing with turntables, just repeating these samples. So I remember just getting this really brilliant rap from Steve. I've always considered him to be somewhat of a genius, and he's still out there recording bands. I know he recently moved to Tacoma. I have a lot of respect for him. And he had a track on the very first Sub Pop 5 cassette. Again, he was on Sub Pop 100. He wound up producing some Nirvana tracks. And I can't say enough good things about Steve Fisk.
I totally agree. Absolutely. Bruce Pavitt is my guest. We're talking about music. We're talking about Sub Pop. We're talking about the Seattle scene. Let's just concentrate on the Seattle scene for a moment, Bruce. You and I were there in the early 80s. And, you know, there was a scene, yet at the same time, there was not a scene as anywhere near like the rest of the world thought there was just a few years later. Your thoughts on that?
Well, the scene in Seattle to me was very inspiring. I'll just give you my take on it, having come from Chicago. Okay.
Yeah.
What blew my mind is that there was so much activity happening in Seattle, and yet being from Chicago and again visiting one of the great record stores of all time, Wax Trax, I had no idea what was happening. And this was typical of the era that you could have a very creative, vibrant scene and nobody else in the world would know about it, especially if you were from a smaller city. And this is one of the reasons I did the zine.
Mm.
So in visiting Seattle from Olympia, I got to visit the Roscoe Louis Gallery, which I'm sure you remember,
run by
Mr. Larry Reed.
Of course, yes.
You had Stella Zine. You had a group called the Blackouts, who did an EP called Men in Motion. You had another group called the Three Swimmers.
Mm-hmm.
So there was a very intelligent, very artful music being made. It was a very vibrant scene. I do remember visiting your store, Corporate Records.
Yes.
I remember you actually bought an ad in one of my early Sub Pop zines.
Yes.
And so we had the store. We had a great little infrastructure. There were a lot of creative people. But post-punk was really self-consciously avant-garde intellectual, pushing the boundaries. That's really what it was all about. And then grunge was really way more populist. So it's a very, very different culture. But a lot of the musicians who are involved in the grunge scene had fed off some of this, I would say, more artful music, as well as hard rock. And so it was a unique synthesis, and the personalities that were involved in the scene, in the later Seattle scene, had been influenced by corporate records and Larry Reed's crazy parties and so forth. It's one of the reasons why the Seattle rock scene in the late 80s was a little richer, because people like Kim Thayil was listening to the Butthole Surfers and so on.
You know, it's so funny you mentioned Kim, because I have recordings of my radio show on Crab, and Kim used to call in regularly. And I remember one time playing, either my ex-wife or I had just come back from London, and I had a test pressing of Turn to Red, Killing Joke's Turn to Red, and Kim Thayil called me up and said, "What is that?" And I've got a recording of him.
Oh, yeah.
It's great stuff. I've got to ask.
What I'm talking about.
Yeah, I've got to ask you about a word that you've mentioned a number of times, and everybody knows this word now, and that's grunge. And I want to get Bruce Pavitt's take on that word. I'm going to take a quick break. When we come back, we're going to hear from Bruce Pavitt and what he thinks of the word grunge.
You're listening to the best show on radio about art, media, and culture. Life Elsewhere with Norman B. Diamond in the back, sun rooftop, digging the scene with the
gasoline. My guest is Bruce Pavitt. He began a record label as a magazine originally, as a fanzine, then it was a cassette label, and then it's put out some vinyl, and gosh, now it's everybody knows the name. They got a shop at Seattle International Airport, in no less. Grunge, God, it seems synonymous. There's a word I'm trying to say properly. It seems like it goes together with Sub Pop, and I'm wondering what you think and what you thought of the word grunge, Bruce.
Well, Norman, You might be aware of the fact that Green River was the first band we worked with, yeah. And the tagline we used in promoting the band's first record was "Ultra Loose Grunge that destroyed the morals of a generation." So we used that word rather tongue in cheek, and the British press kind of ran with it. But I do feel that there was a kind of a common aesthetic that was shared, and that's what we do as historians, you know. Certain painters are referred to as impressionists and so forth. Mm-hmm. So when a group of artists share a similar aesthetic at a similar period of time, there's usually a historical tagline, and I think that's just the way our minds operate. So I think that's totally legit. There was a sound for sure. It was much grittier. A lot of that came through with the production of Jack and Dino, and there was a fashion sensibility too. Most of the musicians playing this stuff didn't have a lot of money, and they were wearing either work clothes or clothes they bought at thrift shops, usually with some kind of ironic logo. And so there was absolutely a look and a sound to what was going on. And when you say the word, people can picture it pretty instantly. So I think that's a legitimate phrase, and it's how we write history.
Artistic
movements.
You explained that very well. You've touched on a word that I just want to focus in on for a moment, and you've mentioned it a couple of times now, fashion. And one doesn't think of grunge or of punk even as being sort of fashionable, but fashion played a very style. Maybe we should call it style or a look. The look was a very important part of music. I mean, going back to Elvis, it was always an important part of my attraction to the music. Then when, you know, the Stones came along, and then we go into the glam thing, and then we go in. It's always been a very important part of the music business. Do you think that it still remains that? I'm going ahead now, Bruce, because you've mentioned it. I'm just going ahead a little bit. Do you think that the look, the style is still as important these days?
Style is, people are always going to look to creative people for inspiration.
Mm.
Okay. And style, clothing style is part of that. If you look at, especially you look at the Beatles, and you can't really separate the music from the sensibility of the performers.
Yeah.
If all of the four Beatles were, let's just say, very unattractive and had bad fashion sense, they probably wouldn't have been as popular as they were. You see what I'm saying?
Mm.
So really, style is part of the game. And the artists who can really bust it out are the ones that are going to leap ahead. The artist Prince comes to mind. Prince had an amazing sense of style.
Mm.
So, you know, the visual is a key component. One thing I will say about grunge is that what it signaled to the rest of the world was, you don't have to have a lot of money to be part of this scene. Mm. Okay, it was very inclusive. If you had a $50 guitar from a thrift store and a pair of jeans with a hole in them, you too could be in a band. And there are some scenes that are exclusive simply by the expense of the instruments. Let's say there's a metal scene, and to be a metal drummer, you need a very expensive drum kit, or you need very expensive clothes, and that signals to the audience that it's an exclusive club.
Yeah.
Mm. So grunge is very inclusive. Anybody could join. Anybody could go to a thrift store and buy an ironic trucker hat for 50 cents and come to a show. And I think that was part of the appeal.
I think you're right. I agree with that. So it's an interesting, there's a whole nother one we could go off on a tangent talking about, and you'd be a fabulous person to talk to. Bruce Pavitt is my guest. You, again, there's another word that you've mentioned a number of times, and that's the business of music. You talk about branding, and that's something that you latched onto very early on. I'd like to delve into this just a little bit with you, Bruce, about branding and about the business, because as we all know, it is a big business. It was at one time just a fantastically huge business. Things have changed over the last, certainly over the last 10 years.
Yes.
Your take on just, and it's a sort of a very large question, but I'd just like to see where it goes. Your take on the business aspects of music. Or the music business.
Well, that's a huge,
yes,
huge, huge question.
It is.
And you know, the just a quick snapshot, you know, the music industry post Napster went into decline for about 15 straight years.
Mm.
And it's just recently started to stabilize and become profitable. And that has to do with streaming and the number of people streaming now. Has gained such momentum that record labels or rights holders are making a lot of money. Now, what we have to bear in mind is that there is a small sliver of very popular artists that continue to get the lion's share of those funds. So when we say, oh, the music industry is doing good, the three majors are profitable, the more popular acts are doing well. But for Indian alternative stuff, it's still very, very challenging. You can only make money off streaming if there's a lot of volume happening there, which is not really the case. So for indie artists, it's really about licensing music to TV shows and films and doing live shows and selling merch. Making money off of recordings is just, it's harder and harder to do. So that's where I see things at this point. It was a whole different ball game when people put out records, and they were a whole different situation.
Yes.
And that's the era that I'm from, and that I relate to, and that I appreciate. And so,
Bruce, this has been an absolute delight talking with you. I want you to choose another piece of music from Bruce Pavitt.
I'm going to pick Totally Wired by The Fall.
You know, it's so funny you say that, because I was thinking to myself, I was looking down the list, and I'm thinking to myself, I bet he chooses The Fall. Totally Wired from The Fall, right here at Life Elsewhere.
I'm totally wired. I'm totally wired.
Just joining us, my guest is Bruce Pavitt. It's such a delight to catch up with you, Bruce, after all this time. I just love it. And that piece of music we just heard was The Fall, of course, Totally Wired. When you first heard that, give me again, I'm just so interested in just your opinions and your take, and just your what was going on for Bruce at the time.
Well, Norman, you got to realize back in the day when people actually listen to records, the experience of hearing the music was in the context of me checking out the artwork. And aside from being really taken with how catchy and raggedy the song is, it had a very unique sleeve, and I'm sure you remember
of
that
course.
Sleeve.
Yes.
Just a die-cut sleeve with a kind of a scribble of a face on the sleeve, and it was so raw and so ridiculous. It was the sleeve was busted out in about 5 seconds, but it was so creative that it worked, and it was a classic example of a creative, resourceful person doing something that was very simple but unique. And it was on Rough Trade, which was my favorite label at the time, so everything they put out had a unique look and sound to it.
My guest has been Bruce Pavitt. An absolute delight talking to you, Bruce. I really appreciate it. Take care of yourself, and we'll talk very, very soon. Thank you for joining us at Life Elsewhere.
I had a great time. Thank you so much, Norman.
You've been listening to A Conversation with Bruce Pavitt, Part 1. Part 2 will air on the next edition of Life Elsewhere. And if you'd like to hear this show again, you've got a lot of options. NPR One, Apple Podcasts, Mixcloud, and all of our wonderful affiliate stations. Details are up at lifeelsewhere.co. Now, make sure you send me feedback. The nice lady will give you my email address in just a moment. Till next time, be well. Be good, and always be nice.
You have been listening to Life Elsewhere, created and hosted by Norman B. Life Elsewhere is written and produced by Norman B. Guest booking and additional research by Stephanie Lane. Behind the scenes assistance by James Van, Bruce Goodman, and Allison Klein. We love to hear what you think about Life Elsewhere. Send your questions, queries, and comments to info@lifeelsewhere.co. That's C-O. Life Elsewhere is produced at the studios of WMNF Tampa.